Welcome to the Sound of One Man Clapping. I am the one man coming to you direct from the bunker, live and well, kicking and fitting, and all the other stuff that I do now that I can do all the other stuff. I am not quite back to 100%, but I am at about 92.4% productivity and activity, and it feels really good. Thank you for your patience. We are going to be going through a very slight change in schedule due to a bump in my work schedule. That being, I have to work for a living. And so as a result, you are going to be getting your episodes early in the week rather than end of the week, because I am going to endeavor to record on Sundays. This is a podcast about board gaming culture, and growing old gracelessly, as I tend to freaking do. This will be a much less sweary episode because I played a lot of board games this week, and playing a lot of board games makes me happy. It's my therapy. I get a lot less stabby. So thank you for bearing with me while I out it. Most of my angst last week, not all, but most, and you, dear clappers, were the brunt of it, and I will be forever grateful. Today, I'm sliding into your DMs with all the unsolicited meeple picks, coming to you direct from the bunker with all the games that were. We're going to talk about what's coming in with incoming! Four exclamation marks. We're going to give FOMO Mofo a break this week due to our change in schedule. This week's releases haven't popped yet, so typically I'd be chatting about what's popped out this week, what's got my eye, what's squeezing the balls of my wallet with both hands and trying to coax all the money out of it. And given that I've only just recorded and posted a couple of days ago, there has been no meaningful shift in that. So we will pick FOMO Mofo up next week. Then we're going to breeze through the voices in my head before giving someone the clap. This week's episode, I am going to unpick the card play specifically in ARX. I'm really excited to do so. But you're going to have to sit back and sit through all the other gobbledygook before we get there. Now onto my favorite part of the show, all the games that were. I'm upright and feeding myself and doing all the other things myself that my beautiful wife had to do for a week, 10 days or so, when I couldn't bend at the waist or the knees or get at anything in the house below the 1.2 meter mark. I am self-sufficient and I am able to hit the record button, and we are here. I played plenty of games from the last week, which is great. I guess plenty subjective, but plenty more than I did the week before. Let me tell you that. So we're going to kick off. We had a family game of Quacks of Quedlinburg, which, as you will all know, dear clappers, is a house favorite. The peanut loves Quacks, the fox loves Quacks, and Lou, my eldest teenager, who loves games, but really is far too busy for games, too busy lying in bed, staring at the wall, moaning about the angst of life, and then interspersing that with huge amounts of needless carbs and Fortnite. Lou loves Quacks. So we were able to get Lou to the table. So it was a game of four. And the last time we played Quacks, the last time I played Quacks with the Fox, was at Super Trooper's house with 00 set. 00 has all the Quacks. You know, all the Quacks, all the bits, all the nice little silky bags, the little boxes that hold it all together. And we were there for, I think it was Buttercup's birthday. And we're playing Quacks. And the Fox sat down at the table and she went, woo! And I know a couple of you have heard this story because I did mention this in a previous episode. And what popped out of her mouth was, why doesn't our copy of Quacks, we don't own Quacks, Quacks is an entirely different game, why doesn't our copy of Quacks look this good? So, I did get the Geek Up bits, which really are spectacular. I didn't get the little flip-top boxes or the little silk bags, because, you know, I got other things to spend my money on that I care way more about. But I'll tell you what, if you like Quacks, the little acrylic potion ingredients are spectacular. And mixing them up and drawing them out and just handling them and just having them on the table, they are great. So we played a game of Quacks. I actually can't remember who won this one. Might have been Lou won this one. Peanut was in the lead for most of the game. And the game went way too long. And then Peanut lost the lead at, like, I don't know, 8:45, which is way outside the Peanut's wheelhouse for happy time. 8:45. And then it was Armageddon. So Quacks nearly ended up in a Monopoly-style table flip. It did not. We were able to restrain her with 3 tranquilizer darts and a Hannibal Lecter-style mask and wrestle her into bed and get her off to sleep. But until such time as she exploded like the Red Hulk, it was a blast. I've said it before, and I'm not going to belabor it so much here. Quax isn't much of a game. You know, you pull a chip out, you put the chip down, you decide if you're going to pull another chip out. Your whole game is, am I pulling another chip? That's not true. You get to spend some money that you may or may not have earned in the round to buy more chips. And some chips bounce off each other really nicely if Mars is in Venus's astrological butthole and you pull the two chips you exactly need in exactly the right order. And that's a huzzah! I got the combo. 9 times out of 10, you do not get the huzzah. You do not get the combo. It's still fun. You pull the chip, you put it down, you count how many little squares or whatever it is they go on, and then you pull another chip. And there's joy, and there's tears, and there's disappointment, and there's table flipping, and there's all kinds of stuff. And Quax is great. We played with the Witches expansion for the first time, and the Witches expansion is a nice little expansion that gives you 3 one-off powers in the game. It gives you a little bit more. It's not that it makes it a meatier game, but it just gives you one more little decision you can make at a critical time to you that lends another little helping hand to these chips come out of your bag. And we love Quax. Quax is great. Following that, I got Lou to stay at the table through no other means other than just asking very politely, because Lou doesn't play a lot of games. But I got Lou to play Compile. And we talked about Compile last week. Compile is my hit of PAX Australia. PAX Australia was the national launch of Compile. And Compile is the new computer sci-fi themed. It's not a reskin, but it's a similar style of gameplay of Air, Land, and Sea. And I think Compile is really clever, and I think it's a really, really good game. Lou wasn't impressed. Lou played one game of Compile and shrugged and went, meh, I don't see what all the fuss is about. Pretty much. Not in those words. I'm paraphrasing. But she's willing to play it again, which is nice, but she wasn't too impressed with Compile on first playthrough, which is, while Lou's never played Air, Land, and Sea, Lou has played hundreds of games of Marvel Snap, and Compile has a real Marvel Snap sort of feel about it. Obviously, you've got to do the work of moving the cards and shifting things around, whereas Marvel Snap goes, well, this is the card you played, and Shazam, all the actions fall into play, but it was great. And then I played 4 games next day, 4 games back-to-back of Nekojima with the Peanut. Now, I know I've talked about Nekojima in the past. Nekojima at 2 is a very different game. Now, Nekojima, for those of you that haven't listened last week or the week before, whenever I touched on Nekojima, it is a dexterity game in which you are placing power poles on a fixed quadrant in a circle playboard, right? You're going to roll dice, and the dice are going to come up with 2 colors. It might be blue and green, whatever it is. And the 2 ends of your power line, you've got a line of a specific length on 2 poles of different lengths. And those poles have to go in 2 different quadrants that are decided by dice. Now, one of those sides of the dice is a black dagger. And if you roll a black dagger, your opponent gets to choose what the other quadrant is. Let me tell you, the Peanut picked up the notion of hate drafting like a little fucking champion. Pardon me, I said it would be less swearing. But she was a little champion, and she picked up the idea of hate drafting. And when this little board is full of poles and lines, and that black dagger comes up, and I've got to put my pole from purple to something, she will look at the board and find the hardest place. And often, if you've got to put it in the same sector, that can often be the hardest move, because the lines can't touch anything. They can't touch other poles. They can't touch the dangly cats that are eventually hanging off the lines. They can't touch other lines. Otherwise, they're grounded. There's electrocution. You make big zapping noises. Everybody jumps and everything falls to the ground. That's a house rule. We always make electrocution noises. And so she got the notion of hate drafting very quickly, to the point where she could discern if that black dagger came up, oh, look, it's going to be near on impossible for you to put the other half of that pole in the purple sector. You could put it in the purple sector. Or if you have to put them in the same sector, so somehow this pole has to go, both of these poles have to go in the same quadrant. So you've got this line that is dangling down between the poles. Your only option is to stack them on top of 2 or 3 other poles. Otherwise, this line is going nowhere fast. You can't wind the poles. You can't do anything clever with that line to make it shorter. You just have to suck it. She thought it was hilarious. I have to take all the blame. I made a couple of hate drafting suggestions when she rolled the black dagger early up in game 1. And she went, I see what you did there, buddy. And it was a blast. Nekojima is so much fun. It's like if Jenga was actually a game. And I don't mean, you know, drinking Jenga or any of those sorts of things. Jenga is like you pull something out, you stack it on top, you go around the circle, you wait for your turn. It's fine. Jenga was a fine game when you're 8 years old. Nekojima is great because there's a lot of fun in placing the poles, but there's also fun in that hate strategy because you not only if you draw black that not only as we've described, if you draw a black cube, you can pick someone at the table to hang a cat. And at one point, I think I had four black cubes on my board because the peanut kept pulling black cube after black cube after black cube on a single turn. And in one turn, I had to hang three black cats. I was foobarred. She thought it was hilarious. Nekojima, check it out. It was so much fun. Finally, clappers, got a game of Arx. Got a game of Arx in. We were hosting games at my place after not being able to play games for about 10 days, and I was very explicit with the boys. I said, I actually have a note from the doctor saying I will recover faster if we get Arx at the table. I know they didn't believe me at all, but if that's what it took, I'd be willing to call my doctor. My doctor's fun enough that he would write that kind of note. And we got a game of Arx to the table. So I'm not going to belabor Arx overly here because there's a part of Arx I want to talk about in Voices in My Head later in this episode. But I do want to say that I think Arx is something that's really, it's a special game. It's Cole Whirley, and it's Cole Whirley, it's Kyle Farinard on the cards. It's a space opera, you know, and if you go do any reading on Arx, you know, allegedly, and I'm going to say allegedly, but all the articles that I've read tell the same story that when Cole Whirley made the game, he made the game as the Blighted Reach campaign, which is a three-game campaign where your characters that you're playing and your factions you're playing evolve throughout the three games and presented to Leader Games. And Leader Games said, "Cole, we love you, but this is bonkers. We can't sell this as a game." And by that, I mean the niche for that game would be so small. Whereas Arx, I wouldn't even call Arx heavyweight. It's probably mid-heavy, maybe not even. It's kind of a midweight euro in that it's not, you don't have the opportunity to plan 3 and 4 turns ahead or moves ahead like you do in something like Voidfall or Lacerda or Anachrony or any other sort of heavy euro, because you're at the behest of this hand of cards, and this hand of cards absolutely holds you hostage through the whole game, and not just your hand of cards, but the hands of cards that are at the table. And as somebody who grew up playing Trick Takers, I'm going to unpick this in detail in Voices in My Head later on. But I think Arx is it's really special. I think it's my favorite to date of Cole Whirley's output. And I haven't played all of his games. You know, I've played Root and Pax Premier and a couple of other things. I would take Arx over Root any day after just one game. And that's to say, you know, quite clearly, if you listened last week, I really like Root. I think Root is a really special game, and I think it's unique in the field of gaming with its deep asymmetry. The asymmetry in Root is so feral that the whole game is that asymmetry. And you have an asymmetry in Arx that is very sort of scant and surface when you draw your faction card and your lore card at the start of the game. But beyond that, your asymmetry is emergent in these market cards that come out of the court. And the Blighted Reach campaign, looking into that, it leans into this emergent asymmetry that I can't tell you how excited I am to play. I probably would like to have one more good game of Arx, you know, around the table, maybe with two lore cards and the boys, just to really sort of cement the core understanding. But I want to leap into that campaign as soon as I can and really start chewing it up, because all I read about it and all I see about it and all I hear about it and all I've learned about it is that that's the actual game, is the campaign, and that emergent asymmetry, it looks to me to be something absolutely unique in our world of games. Anyway, played Arx with Battleships and Super Trooper. I think the consensus around the table was that thumbs up, Arx was good. I don't know that anyone thought Arx was great on game one, but that Arx was good, and certainly there was an interest in playing it again. Battleships wiped the table with us. I think I finished with 10 points, and you know, part of that has to do with I mismanaged the play style for the faction that I drew. I was playing the Demagogue, which has some very powerful, and again, I am not going to go knee deep into Arx because there's a million videos and reviews about Arx out there, but basically you have this market of cards and they enhance your play. And the faction that I drew was leaning very heavily into this court of cards as its source of strength in the game. And so I lent into that, and then partway through round one, I also punched deep into the battle scene, which was my mistake. It was a mistake for me as that particular faction, because while everyone can battle, the fact that the faction I was playing leaned so heavily into the court and using the court to their advantage as a way to, I guess, farm strength, meant that I was left battling and enjoying the battles, but completely eviscerated from my capability to go back to that market over and over again for various reasons, which, you know, again, I misread how I should play that particular faction, and it was our first game, so who cares? Right? Who cares? It was the first game. I still loved it. Loved everything about it. And we'll go deeper into that. Arcs was great. It was really, really great. I will say that one of the things that I learned out of my first game, having a faction that leaned heavily into the court, meant that, you know, for those that haven't played, what you can do is you can influence these cards in the court with your agents. You pop your agents on them, and your agents give you majority on these cards, and then as an action, if you have majority, you can collect those cards, and they enhance your capabilities. I had all my agents out, and I couldn't get them back, because the only way to get agents back to you if somebody else claims the card is through a specific scoring mechanic, which then clears all the agents out of all the cells, and I actually literally mean jail cells in the different faction planets, and return them to the owner. And that didn't happen until round five. So I literally castrated myself in about round two and was left with nothing to embolden my particular faction for three rounds. In hindsight, I realized I could have forced that scoring to happen, which I believe is the tyrant scoring, even though I wasn't in the running for it. It would mean at least, you know, while I'm handing points out to other people, it would mean all of these agents would come back to me, you know, and in theory, there'd be some learning round on round so I could have a better finish than I did. As I said, I finished on 10. I think battleships had 40 or 42, something like that. I was way, way, way behind, but I learned a lot. And what I learned is that I really liked the game. That's Arcs. I could say Arcs is probably not for everybody's collection, but it is a unique bit of gameplay. It's not a space battle game. It's in as much that, yes, there's space battle, but your battle is a mechanic to not just kill other ships, but to gain resources from your opponents that you perhaps can't afford or can't get in any other way. It's a bit take that, but there's so much risk attached to it. I have to say, you know, it wasn't enacted very often in our particular game, because the risk of trying to play that take that, which involves a certain set of weighted dice, and by weighted, I mean they're heavy. I mean, they're weighted heavily into that sort of capability. There's so much risk associated to you as the player, not just the person you're trying to take from, that it really wasn't something that was done very often until late game, when people were like, well, screw this. I need that. And the only way I'm going to get that is to take it from you. And the push-pull of that risk, I think, is amazing. I really do. Because if you use the weaker dice, they're safe, but it's a bit like Stormtrooper shooting. You know, I think Battleships had a couple of battles where he rolled the dice and they all came up blank. And it was like, pew, pew, off into space. And that's your whole turn done. You know, that action rather than turn. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to learn in Arcs. And it's not a hard game to learn. I think when you start playing Arcs, you know, you watch a video and you read the book or whatever the case is, it's not that hard to teach or learn. I think it's hard to play and it's hard to win. And I love that about it. And we're going to come back to that later. Also got a game in of Scholars of the South Tigris, a game that was following up from Arcs with Battleships and Super Troopers. I've talked about Scholars before. I love Scholars. It's a favorite in the bunker. Scholars has a lot of moving parts, and fundamentally it's a dice worker placement game. One of the things I love about Scholars is the way it leans into the color wheel, such that you have primary color dice and secondary color dice, and some actions you want to take require a specific number of pips. Some actions only require a specific color of die, and the strength is irrelevant. And some of the actions require you to have the right number of pips and the right color to get what you want done. And the dice colors can be mitigated or adjusted using different color workers. So you can make a red die purple by putting a blue worker on it. You can make a yellow dye orange by putting a red dye on it, a red worker on it. You could have a red and a yellow dye, and that becomes an orange dye for all intents and purposes. And it's not optional. You can't put a red and a yellow dye to say, well, I want this red dye to be more powerful, because you also add the pips up of the dice that come. So there's that, again, that fierce push-pull of what do I want to do this turn, and how do I use the dice I have to get what I want. And I'm not a huge fan of chucking dice on the table. Cthulhu Death May Die I love, because in the end, by the time you get into the game, you're chucking 400 dice on the table, you know, and the risk of going completely insane versus doing something totally amazing is awesome. Too Many Bones I love, but you're rolling dice and you have so many ways to mitigate the dice with different cards or different combinations of powers, or with your bank of bones that you can use. And rolling these dice at the start of each round after resting gives you these dice with all these different pips and all these different colors. And then the puzzle is up to you as to how do you want to use those. If I only have white dice, how do I get a blue die? Well, there's a space over there that will give me a blue worker. If I get a blue worker, I could turn one of my other white dice into a blue die. You are never locked out by these dice. And, you know, I'm not going to say I've played a ton of Garfield games. I think I've probably played 5 Garfield games. I think at this point, Scholars is my absolute favorite. I think it's crunchy, it's meaty. The decision space is absolutely, it's almost sandboxy. You've got this whole thing, you've got this whole board of spaces, and on the board you've got a ton of choices. 35 choices, like Feast for Odin choices, right? Like it is a wild board of choices, and the AP potential with Scholars is huge. But it's certainly my favorite of the Garfield games. And then we followed up Scholars. I followed that up with 3 games of Compile. Again, there's a bit of a theme here. Went back to Compile. I said to Super Trooper, do you want to play a bit of Compile? And he said, hell yes, let's do that. Because he loves both Air, Land, and Sea and Marvel Snap. So we got it out. It was literally a 3-minute teach because it was easy to slide into. And between Friday afternoon and Saturday morning, because I was back at the table with Super Trooper Saturday morning with a different group, we played 3 games of Compile, and I think Super Trooper really loved it. You know, I think he got the gameplay immediately because, as I said, he's played Air, Land, and Sea, he's played Marvel Snap. The interplay between the different factions, the back and forth and the push-pull of the control card, because the control card gives you this really unique ability to manipulate where the scoring conditions are on your opponent's board, which has a very small window of applicability, but it's a very powerful thing to do. And once you understand the applicability of that, it's a remarkable little bit of catch-up mechanic. You know, if you're behind, and I won't go into the minutiae of it because the punchline of it is far less exciting than just stating outright that it's a really clever bit of catch up. If you're behind and your opponent's about to compile his 3rd row, you can basically say, well, now you have to compile that row instead, and all his work in row 1 is wasted. His cards are in row 1 and he now has to compile row 3, and it gives you a little breathing room to catch up, and it is excellent. The more I play Compile, the more I really, really like Compile. And I think Compile is going to very quickly become one of my favorite little fillers on games day, because in between big years, you know, our most often play count is 3. Compile is only a 2-player game, but usually in between games, somebody's off putting lunch together, or somebody's got to pop out and pick up one of the daughters, or has got to go and do something. So in between games, we kind of have 20 minutes of downtime often. And Compile is going to, I think, very quickly become my favorite thing to slot in there. And then Saturday morning, I got in a scenario of Frosthaven. Long time between drinks of water. Oh my goodness gracious. Frosthaven I love. And I can't even tell you when I started Frosthaven with... started with Super Trooper and Coop. Coop's the owner of Frosthaven. Coop owns everything Frosthaven. Every upgrade, everything you can get. He's got the Laserox 17-foot shipping container that holds everything Frosthaven. The beautiful player dashboards, which probably cost more than half my board games, and I'm not Coop's single with no kids, man. If I was single with no kids, I would own all that shit. You better believe I would. I looked at the Aeon Trespass insert from Laserox. It is glorious. It's $300 Australian. And I'm like, yeah, no, I have things like children to pay for. So, but I love, love, love playing Frosthaven with the boys. So yesterday it was Super Trooper, Coop, Dusty, and myself. I'm not even going to use the word unfortunately. I think I've played a dozen scenarios of Frosthaven, maybe. And I could go back and look. It's 10 or 12. And started very early in the campaign. And the beautiful thing about Frosthaven is you can drop in and out. You can build your own character, drop in and out. And so you can have 5 or 6 or 7 people playing the campaign. And you can get different groups of them to the table at different times. And that's the great thing, is that my inability to attend Frosthaven days hasn't held up the campaign for these guys. And so I don't think I've played Frosthaven in, it would be 4 or 5 months. And that's not for lack of desire or lack of even time. It's just lack of having time on the right days. You know, when this is all getting together and people are getting together to play Frosthaven, my being available on that exact day, I've got a lot of availability to and fro and up and down. You know, my schedule is really quite flexible in a lot of ways. But getting 3 or 4 people together to play this specific game is challenging. And knowing that you can get 5 or 6 different people to the table through different schedules and still have a game of it, because you could do it with 2. And I know the boys have at some point done it with 2. So I was able to join for 1 scenario yesterday, and I know the guys, after I left, played 2 more. And this one scenario, I'm playing the Inox Drifter, who's one of the first characters out of the box. And that's what I was starting to say. It's like, unfortunately, I'm still playing a starting character. And it's not. It's not unfortunate at all, because I really like this character. He's got some really, really cool capabilities and some really great cards and some really interesting push-pull. He's not an overly complex character, which is probably good given that, you know, it's been 4 months since I played and I was able to sit down and re-grok what the character can do very easily and pick it up and run with it. But I really love it. Essentially, the Drifter's got all these abilities that you can buff. So you can play a card on the table. And if you haven't played Gloomhaven or Jaws of the Lion or Frosthaven, they're all, you know, that Isaac Childress design of card play. I'm not going to bog you down with it, because if you haven't played these games, probably means you're not interested in them too much. But what you can do is you can play a card onto the table and it has either a temporary or semi-permanent effect. And the Drifter has these semi-permanent effects where you pop them on the table and you put a timer button on them, and the button will move along each time you use that card. So the card might have 6 charges. And every time you use the card, it will buff something, whether that's a heal or a move or a melee or a ranged attack or the distance of your ranged attacks, whatever the case is. And when it's been used 6 times, the card expires and it goes. But what the Drifter also has is a number of abilities that recharge those cards. So this particular scenario we were playing yesterday was basically a room full of shit. Right, and I'm not talking about bad guys, but it was just like the whole room was debris and you couldn't move until we were like Lord of the Rings mining dwarves for half of this scenario, just hammering away at these flipping rocks. I'm not, spoiler alert, I'm not going to tell you what scenario it is. It's about halfway through, blah blah blah. If you're playing, you'll forget by the time you get there. But there's no real spoiler anyway. You've got to hammer through these rocks to get to the other side while you've got these great big ugly things with incredible range lobbing crap at you the whole time. And I had a great combination of cards for the scenario, and I had it was looking really dire, like, but halfway through we looked at each other across the table and just went, like, because your only option then is to play the scenario again, which isn't terrible. I remember one time, I think we played the same scenario 3 times, you know, and that's not terrible. It's not my preferred way to play Frosthaven, but this was a bit of a grind to get through the first room. And when we burst through into that third room, and because you can't see what's in the room until you open it, and looked at what was in the room and went, oh, we might actually do this 4 hours after we'd started, right? Like, it was 4 hours of grinding through this stuff, and we opened the last door and we could see the room and the stuff that's in there, what we have to do. And it still looks tough. We were still looking at that going, yeah. But we managed to get through. And it was awesome. And there's one time in the last room when Dusty was queued up for this power move. this absolute power move. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to do this and this and this and this and this. And here it comes. And he flipped over the modifier card and it was a crit fail. And honestly, we laughed for 2 minutes straight. Not because we were laughing at Dusty and his crit fail, but because it was very Frosthaven that at the moment when you so desperately, you know, the dramatic music was rising to a crescendo and the orcs are coming over the field and Gandalf has appeared at the top and the dawn has risen and everyone falls off their fucking horses, right? It was just, we were laughing and laughing. And we did it in the end. I was lucky enough that I'd managed my cards really well and I had a really nice big power move to clear the way a little bit. And, Coop was pulling up the rear with this thing that we had to drag through the whole scenario, like triumphantly dragging it to the exit, and we did it. It was great. Frosthaven's great. It's not for everybody. Frosthaven is an investment and a half, much like ATO is going to be an investment and a half. But I had a great, great time, and unfortunately I couldn't stay much longer. I didn't have a lot of time up my sleeve yesterday. But getting that one scenario done was outstanding. So I had a great week for games. Thank you very much to everyone involved. I'm smiling again. I'm less likely to hurt somebody, and I'm a lot less sweary. You can see, games are good. Boxes on the doorstep, new delights inside. Heaven's on fire, feels to divide. Now onto my favorite part of the show, it's incoming with 4 exclamation marks. There's not a ton incoming this coming week. There's been a lot incoming in the last weeks, but we're coming to the part of that's a lot of coming. Incoming and incoming and coming. My apologies for all the coming. We're coming up to a part of the year where things will kind of accelerate. As I said last week, I've got 11 different projects that are due in over the next basically 7 weeks. So it's going to be an exciting time. But the one that I'm expecting to arrive tomorrow, which I am wildly hopeful that we'll get to the table in the next couple of weeks, is the final installment of the South Tigris trilogy from the eternally amazing law firm of Phillips and MacDonald, that being Garfield Games, and that is Inventors of the South Tigris. Now, Inventors of the South Tigris, I won't go into the gameplay, largely because I don't know the gameplay in excruciating detail, but I will say it looks to be, this is on my limited, as I said, exposure to Garfield Games, but it's also intermingled with my viewing and understanding of other opinions of this game. This looks to be the heaviest board game put out by Garfield to date. I was talking to Super Trooper about it on, I think, Friday, and he commented that it has the bones and, I guess, nuts and bolts of the feel of a Lacerda game, not in its presentation, because the art style is very different, obviously, and not in its theming, because the theming on Garfield Games could be considered loose at best some days. And that's not a slight. I love the South Tigris games. I really, really do. But I think in the depth of the gameplay and the intermingling parts and the prerequisites of different actions, I think is what he was referring to. And I think I'd agree, having watched a couple of videos, there's a really great early gameplay by the Brothers Murph. If you want to go find that one, those two dudes do a really great early gameplay of Inventors when it's very early on in its release schedule. And it looks very complex and very meaty and very weighty, probably low to mid fours, which is certainly into the heavy part of the medium weight games. And I'm really looking forward to it. It's got the same dice mechanics. It looks like it leans into a little bit of colored dice. It's dice worker placement, as all the South Tigris games are. But the art matches up, and the little asterisk tokens that you've got for influence are being used through all three games. The exciting part of this is next year that Garfield Games is going to be releasing an expansion set, which has an expansion for all three games. That's Wayfarers, Scholars, and Inventors. And then an overarching three-game campaign, which I know they've done in the past. I've not had the pleasure of playing them. But there's an overarching three-game campaign, and it's going to be called the South Tigris Moon Saga. And so that is going to be going live sometime in the next 2 to 6 months. I don't have dates for you, but as soon as I do, I will let you know, because this is something that I will be watching very closely, because I think it would be really great to play these three games, not necessarily back to back in one day, although if it was just Super Trooper and I, we easily could on a long Friday or a long Saturday, we can knock them over. Wayfarers, two players, only about 75 minutes. Scholars, we can get through in about 90 minutes, realistically. So getting through three of those in one day would be chunky, but totally doable. And I'm really looking forward to what that looks like. That's all there is for me to cover this week on Incoming. It's pent up. That's been sitting around for about 10 days. And as I said earlier, FOMO Mofo will be delayed a week due to the change in our recording schedule here at OMC. We'll get through this week. I know there's some great stuff coming out this week that I'm watching, but I'm not going to open Pandora's box on those just yet. We'll be back next week to talk about those in detail, because there are some things that I'm very excited about. Now onto my favorite part of the show, Voices in My Head. This is where we go through all the ramblings of the game that of the week, or what I want to talk about most, or my favorite things, or my least favorite things, or where's itchy this week. You're going to get it all. So this is Voices in My Head, and this week I want to talk about Arx the card game. Now this is not a different game. This is not an Arx universe game. This is not something new coming up by Leader Games and Cole Worley. I want to talk specifically about the card play in Arx, because there's a lot of coverage of Arx out there. I mean, a lot. There's a lot of coverage. You want to watch some great coverage. I think Shut Up and Sit Down did a two-part episode on Arx, which was effusive in praise and very detailed as a review and overview, which will give you all the information you need to decide whether this game's for you. But I don't know that I've heard anyone really unpick the card play component. So Arx is really a game of two parts. You've got five chapters you're playing through, and the first part of the game, and when I say the first part, it's the first part of your turn, is you're going to play a card. And that card is going to dictate what you can do. And I will say, going into my first play of Arx, because everything I've seen or heard or read about Arx, it's all been described as trick-taking adjacent, or trick-taking light, or trick-taking-ish. And I've got a hot take. I don't think that's the case at all. I think the trick-taking in Arx fundamentally underpins your success in every possible way. I don't think this is trick-taking light or trick-taking adjacent. I think this is trick-taking pure, because you're playing one card, and that one card on how you play it, well, maybe two cards, and we'll get to that. That one card, depending how you play it, is going to fundamentally discern your whole turn, but also how well you set up for the next turn. In Arx, you've got a hand of cards, and there are four suits from memory. That part's irrelevant. And the cards are numbered 1 to 7. And in anything but a four-play game, you're only playing with the cards numbered 2 to 6. The lower your card, the lower its power, but the more actions it has. So, for example, if you play a 2, you're going to get 4 actions in whatever the suits are. So the suits are, one of the suits allows you to battle. One of the suits allows you to influence the court. One of the suits allows you to build or repair. Examples. Don't worry about that. That part's irrelevant. So the lower your card, the more actions you're going to get. And the higher your card, the fewer actions you're going to get, but the more likely it is that you're going to be able to lead next turn. Now, more than that, here's a minutia of the rule that I missed in my watchings of videos and my reading before we played. If Super Trooper leads with a red 2, which is the battle suit, a red 2... two's a bad example. Say leads with a red 4. And I don't have the 5 or 6. So if I don't have the 5 or 6, I only get one action. So if he leads with the 4, he's going to get 3 actions, because there are 3 pips on the 4. The 5 and 6, I think, have 2 pips from memory. And if you don't have one of those, you're only going to get one action. So you have a choice. You can supersede the card that is played in the same suit and get all the actions on your card. Or you can play the card face down and get one action in that suit. Or you can play a different card face up and get one action in that other suit. So you think you've played trick-taking before. I've played a lot of trick-taking games. And you're like, well, I want to lead. I want to win the trick. Right? So the easiest way to win a trick is to play a hide card in a suit that you know no one else can beat. And that means you're going to get to choose your action every turn. And that's great. But it's also not your best move. So let me explain. First chapter we played, I drew, you get six cards in your hand. I drew 4 sixes, and I'm like, phew, Shazam! I'm gonna rule this chapter, and I did. Because you play a six as high as it goes. No one can beat it. So I played a six. My six gave me 2 actions. All my opponents got 1 action. Ha ha! Sucked in. You got 1 action. I got 2. Yeah. No. Remember earlier when I said I finished the game with 10 points? So hold on. So you play a six, you get to lead. So if I play 4 sixes in a row, I get 4 turns where I get to choose the action. Absolutely get to choose the action. And I will get 2 of those, and I know everyone else is only getting 1. That sounds great, right? So in my hand, I also had a 2 and a 3. So a 2 has 4 actions. So you play a 2, you get 4 actions with a 2. However, somebody else plays a card higher than yours, then they're going to take the lead for the next round. So you play a 2, you get your 4 actions, and then you know you get your 4 actions, you get a power move, but you can absolutely count on the fact that you are not leading next turn. And if you play Trick Takers, I grew up playing bloody Bridge and Hearts and Spades and all this garbage with my grandmother. You know, it was a nightmare as a child. You're 8 years old, I don't play Bridge. Why am I playing Bridge at 8? You want to win tricks, right? You play the Crew, you want to win tricks. You play, I mean, Fox in the Forest, you want to win some tricks at least. You play Cat in the Box, you want to win some tricks. Here, you don't want to win all the tricks either. And it's not immediately explicit when you're playing arcs that that's the case, or even why you will want to not win tricks, because leading means you get to pick. So, I played my 6, I get 2 actions, they get 1 action each. And to be honest, when you only get 1 action, playing a card face down and losing it, or playing a card face up for the action you want, it's irrelevant. You're playing 1 card, you get 1 action. You play 1 card, you get 1 action. And I thought, yeah, I've screwed the guys. Woo, yay me! I screwed myself. And I'll tell you why. Because playing a 2 is the power move. Playing a 2 gives you 4 actions. Playing a 2 gives you 4 actions. You are guaranteed to lose the lead for the next round, but you're going to get 4 actions. And like all strategic games, Arcs is an action efficiency game. And the thing I like about Arcs is that it's going to really fuck with the AP people, because you can't plan 3-4 turns ahead. You've got to play the cards you've got. You absolutely have to play the cards you got. Now, here's the twist that I love. And I didn't love it until about 10 o'clock Friday night when I digested my game of Arcs. If Super Trooper plays a 4 of red and I only have a 2 of red, which I would then have to play face down for 1 action. I can burn another card face down. So I burn through 2 of my 6 cards, but I am absolutely guaranteed the initiative. I'm absolutely guaranteed that I'm going first next turn. Okay, so I'm guaranteed to go first at the expense of a whole turn. And that seems overly costly at first, right? Like you've got 6 actions, you've got 6 cards, you see that 6 actions. If you're not leading, that's literally 6 actions. Because if you can't surpass the card that's played, for whatever reason, because you don't have the right suit, you're going to be playing all these cards face down for 1 action each. And in a chapter, you're going to get 6 actions. And I would posit that mathematically, the best move is to steal the lead and then play your lowest card. And then when someone surpasses you with that lowest card, you immediately steal the lead again and you play your lowest card. Okay, so what that looks like is this. So let's say I'm going first. I play the 2 of orange, which allows me to influence cards, among other things. So guaranteed, all the cards are out there. You don't have to count cards to know that somebody's going to beat that card. So I play the 2 of orange and I'm going to get 4 actions, right? Everyone else is going to get a more powerful card down, which means at some point I'm going to lose in that turn. I'm not going to have the initiative for the next round, but I'm going to get 4 actions. So then Super Trooper plays the 4, which gives him 3 actions, and then Battleships plays the 6, which gives him 2 actions. So I've had 4 actions. He's had 3. Battleships had 2. I've had 4 actions my first turn. So then Super Trooper plays next, and he plays the 4 of red. And I'm like, well, I have the 5 of red. Ha ha. I can play that and steal it back. So do that. Play the 5 red, I steal it back. But if I don't have any of these things could beat him. He plays the 4 of red. I don't have the 5 of red. I don't have the 6 of red. I can play a card face down. That'll give me 1 action. So if you're mathing this out, I've played 2 cards so far for 5 actions. Right? I got 4 my first turn, and one on my second turn. And Super Trooper's gotten 3 on his first turn and 2. So we're tied at 5. So then my best move is to take one of my mid-tier cards, my 3s, 4s, or 5s, whatever the case is, and play it face down. So I get one action and I'm going first next turn. Right? So I've now lost one of my 6 turns in its entirety. Play through that. Next round, I play another 2 or a 3, which gives me 4 or 3 actions respectively. Okay, so now I've given up an entire turn in the round, which on a bad, in bad card play, is going to be 1 turn. Like if I'm not leading and I can't surpass, I'm giving up mathematically probably 1 action to then lead and take 3 or 4 actions. And this is so counterintuitive to be giving away turns in a round in a strategic Euro is so counterintuitive that it literally hurt my brain when this occurred to me to think that it's a better move for me to take 4 turns against the other guy's 6 than it is to eke those out on to take 6 turns and make sure that I'm keeping up with the board state. And yes, you want to keep up with the board state, but in an action efficiency game, the most actions is going to, I'm going to say most actions wins. It's not. You still have to be clever. But if you've got 2 people of equivalent capability who both grok the game to the same level, and I've got 10 more actions than the next guy, you're toast, buddy. You got no hope. You got no hope. If I get 10 more actions than you, like, you're out. Now, I'm not saying we're all equal capabilities or we all understand the game equally. But for me to take those 6 cards and maybe only get 4 turns, but 2 of those turns are going to have 3 or 4 actions, I'm likely burning 2 cards that are a single action for possibly 2 turns with up to 8 actions. There went my brain. Right? There went my brain when I was like, you play, as I said, I started the game. First draw, I had 4 sixes. And I'm like, yeah, it's on me. I played a 6. Screw you guys. I got 2 actions. You got 1. Whatever the case is. You know, they got 1. I got 2 actions. You got 1. I got 2 actions. You got 1. I got 2 actions. You got 1. I was the king of round 1. And as you may recall from earlier in the episode, all of my agents were out by the start of round 2. I had no agents to play in that card market. And I thought, well, I'm the king of round 1. I'm going to do some combat in round 1. Great. I did some combat. Didn't help me any. Because I didn't understand the deep, deep decision space on when to burn your cards. Because in arcs, I'm telling you right now, and I stand by this, 4 turns in a chapter is going to be better than 6 turns if you play it right. And it's not hard to play it right. And so when you draw your 6 cards, you're like, oh, these cards are shit. Like, ah. What you do is you take the 4 that you want to interplay. You want 2 low cards, you want 2 high cards, and 2 mid cards on wherever they land. And your 2 mid cards are the ones you spend to steal the initiative, to play those 2 low cards. And then the 2 high cards are the ones that you hope surpass when someone else has the initiative. And that, when that hit me, you know, 3 glasses of wine into a Friday night, and I'm digesting, and I went, wait a minute, this is not trick-taking light, okay? And I'm not saying this is formulaic, where you can take what I've just laid out and win. But I can tell you that I can see taking 4 turns in a chapter and sitting out for 2 whole turns possibly being far more powerful, far more action-efficient, merely because it's going to generate so many more actions. And I got to take my hat off to Cole Whirley, because this little bit of the game, which has been described as trick-taking light, and I suppose you could call it trick-taking light because it's not a trick-take. We're not going round and round and round and round and round, and most tricks wins. But looking at the board state and what you need to do and deciding which 4 turns you want to play out of the 6, because you can take 6 turns. You could take 6 turns, and if you get stunked out on 5 of those 6 tricks, you are going to be getting 1 action per turn. So let's say you play a 2 for 4 actions in your first turn and you get screwed in the last rounds because you can't get the initiative back for whatever reason. You're going to get basically 7 actions in the turn. And you can't win that way. Particularly when you're playing a faction that thrives on the court cards and you can't get your people out of the court because you've gone, I'm going to choose Warlord because that sounds great because this is a space game. I'm going to roll dice. Yeah, stupid, but whatever. I had fun. I want to say that I think that the card play in arcs is the meatiest bit of arcs, and it's over in a half a second. Right, you play your card and then you move on. The head game that I will be playing with myself next game, because I'm not smart enough to count cards. You know, it's only 20 cards. And so we deal six out, there's two spares, discards face down, you can't see them. It's only 20 cards, but there's so much to internalize about the board state. It's going to be very hard to count cards. But for me to look at the cards I have and decide where I want them to weigh in, you can control that. You can control that with the power of playing face down cards at the right time. And yes, many of us played face cards down at the right time. But understanding that that mechanic is actually better and smarter than keeping all six cards, that's a big deal. When you've been playing trick-taking games for forever, and we've been hardwired to think, well, if you can't play a round, you cannot win. Being in the trick is not as relevant as maximizing your actions, and I absolutely love that about this game. I absolutely loved it. I didn't love it at the time because I didn't understand it at the time, but I can't wait for Game 2 of Arx, and I can't wait to see what the Blighted Reach holds for us. And Arx the card game. There's more than just play a card and win the trick to get first. Getting first is great. You need to be first in order to declare an ambition, and you need to be able to declare an ambition, which is the five different scoring conditions. You need to be able to have the scoring condition declared that suits you in order to win the game. But you can declare an ambition with a two. You just have to be first. So there it is. Arx the card game, guys. I think it's exceptional. It's not a game by itself. You couldn't publish Arx the card game, and it would, you know, because it's the actions that feed off that trick taking that are the triumph for me. And the absolute minimalist rules, and I think that's where it's being called trick-taking light or trick-taking adjacent, because it's very minimalist. You beat the card in suit, or you play a card face down, or you play another card face up, and you're taking one action either way. But the power play of deciding to take less turns to get more actions, I think is really going to make a very interesting game too. And the boys at the table, Super Trooper and Battleships, may totally disagree with me. They might go, hey, Hammers, you're off your chops. You know, no way, man. Like, you, and maybe I am. Send me a message. Tell me I've missed something or I'm wrong. And if I'm wrong, that's great, because I'm going to learn something else about it. If there's something I've missed, or there's some other adjunct long arm of the mechanic that sweeps around it, but this is what I see and this is what I love. And I take my hat off to you, Cole. I think it's spectacular. Now onto my favorite part of the show, where we give someone the clap. This week's clap goes to somebody very special who well deserves it. Somebody who has been through so much and done so much for board gaming, and so much for me and board gaming specifically. And doesn't even listen to the podcast. Guaranteed isn't going to hear it because they don't listen. They're not a fan. And that is the Fox. My dear Fox, you are amazing in every possible way. And she's getting the clap because I spent 10 days flat on my ass, unable to contribute. We have a house of five, with three girls in this house and two cats. And one of those cats is incontinent at an Olympic level. And so the house has a lot of work in it. And to the Fox, my dear, dear Fox, who makes my life so worth living and who has bequeathed unto me the bunker as it is, and the freedom to be in the bunker as much as I like, or to go and play board games to my heart's content, because she recognizes that board games are a form of therapy, that they make me a better person, that they make me a happier person, they make me a calmer person, they bring me joy. To my dear Fox, I could not be more grateful to anyone in this world, and I'm sorry it's taken to episode 7 to put you on this list, but the last 10 days has really spelled out to me that you are the number one. Here is your clap. And that concludes this week's overview of how I spend my days. Next week's gaming schedule is looking alarmingly light due to my shift in work schedule. But no work means no board games. So I would 100% be a trophy husband if I could. I do not have the chiseled looks for that. I unfortunately like cheese way too much. So it'll be a bit light on games. There's some games coming, I know. But Friday Gaming with the Boys is off because I will be working, and then the Fox and I are going away this weekend for 3 days with no children, which is amazing. I will probably sneak a couple of board games into the bag because, you know, she's a captive audience, Stockholm Syndrome, all that stuff, her boyfriend's not around, blah, blah, blah. You know how it goes. She can't get away. Anyway, that's the week. You can reach us on all the socials. You can find us on Facebook by searching One Man Clapping. You can email me personally on onemanclapping, that's onemanclapping@gmail.com. I'm on Instagram at @one1manclapping. And you can join the One Man Clapping Guild on BGG. Subscribe to Guild 4426. I don't know why you would, because there's nothing there. But, you know, it only takes a few seconds, and the day comes when all of a sudden we've got Vitalis Serta himself in there talking about his new game. We've got the worldwide exclusive on it. That's not in the plans. That's not happening. I'm just, you know, dreaming big. For the 10 seconds it takes to join, you will be in the waiting room. Thank you, as always, for your time. It has been an unmitigated pleasure to just sit in the bunker by myself and make out with the microphone. If that makes you feel dirty, you're welcome. Until next time, get your game on, even if you've got to play with yourself. And remember, bending cards is bad, okay? Bending cards, it's bad. Peace out, mofos. Seriously, stop bending the cards.